there's a large number of different types of events or incidents that take place, and one of the common themes is alcohol and drug use.
New rules aim to curb alcohol use on the Army base in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers attend an anti-abortion rally in Juneau on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
Supreme Court still is the supreme law of the land, but life is given of God. The Supreme Court doesn't understand it yet, but they will answer to God.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, welcoming Clare House residents to their new home. Learn more at cssalaska.org. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Army officials are admitting that they have an alcohol and drug problem at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, and they're doing something about it, banning alcohol in the barracks. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Commanders have agreed to implement policies to curb alcohol-related disciplinary problems on base and in Anchorage, according to Lieutenant Corporal Bill Kuppernall, a spokesman for the U.S. Army in Alaska. He says the new policies will be aimed at improving discipline and standards and include an alcohol ban.
The policy hasn't been written yet, but we do anticipate restricting alcohol in the barracks on post.
Soldiers over 21 will still be permitted to drink alcohol at the one club on the J. Bear Richardson side of the base, Kuppernall says, as well as to drink off post. There's already a ban on alcohol in barracks on the Air Force side of the base, a spokesman for the U.S. Air Force in Alaska says. Kuppernall says the ban on alcohol in Army barracks is part of a larger strategy.
It's not one single policy. It's really a number of different initiatives that are aimed at reducing the number of disciplinary issues and alcohol-related incidents across U.S. Army Alaska.
Kuppernall says the U.S. Army in Alaska is also considering routine checks by officers on base, as well as increasing courtesy patrols in downtown Anchorage to make sure soldiers are staying out of trouble. He says service members are already provided with a phone number to call for a ride if they go out and drink too much. Officials are also reviewing existing policies concerning guns.
Disciplinary issues that involve weapons are pretty risky behavior. If there's a mistake or there's events that take place with alcohol and firearms, that makes it even worse. So we're looking at those and making sure that the policies that already exist are enforced.
About 4,000 deployed soldiers returned to J-Bear in 2012, and Kuppernall says alcohol-related disciplinary problems have been on the rise lately.
There's a large number of different types of events or incidents that take place, and one of the common themes, whether it be suicide gestures or abuse, sexual assaults or fights in the barracks, and one of the common themes is alcohol and drug use.
Kuppernall says urinalysis tests are already administered to soldiers to uncover drug use. Rules vary for drinking on base, but generally drinking is allowed for those 21 years and older when they're not on duty. A National Army spokesperson didn't have information on how common it was for bases to ban alcohol on barracks. A spokesman for Joint Base Lewis McChord near Tacoma, Washington, says there's not a ban on alcohol in barracks for Army or Air Force personnel there. The new alcohol policies at J. Bear Richardson, including the alcohol ban in barracks, will officially begin in February. But Kuppernall says lower-level commanders may already be implementing it. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Just one day after President Obama's inauguration, Congress returned to the fight over whether to raise the nation's borrowing limit. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, many Republicans are unwilling to extend the debt limit, and Congressman Don Young won't commit either way.
In the last news conference of his first term, President Barack Obama made clear Congress needs to raise the debt ceiling so the government can meet its obligations.
The issue here is whether or not America pays its bills. We are not a deadbeat nation.
Last week, House Republican leaders dropped their official opposition to what's called a clean debt ceiling increase, meaning they won't require any spending cuts to accompany the bill. But they won't cede too much power to the president. Instead of a long-term extension, which the president wants, leaders opted for a 3-month stopgap. That gets the nation through two other major fiscal fights, the across-the-board spending cuts scheduled to start March 1st and the expiration of a bill funding the government. That bill, known as the Continuing Resolution, will end March 27th. The House GOP formulated their new plan at a weekend retreat in Williamsburg, Virginia, a retreat Congressman Don Young skipped. He normally supports the party leadership, but this time around, that's no guarantee.
I am not sure I'm going to vote for it. I'm not really happy with the idea that we said we weren't going to do it now as we cut spending. And if we don't do it now, are we going to do it when sequestration takes effect? And sequestration itself will probably be more damaging than working on a deal.
The Tea Party lost congressional seats in the past election, but those who remain are as vocal as ever and pose a hefty threat to Republican leaders. Tea Party Congressman Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, says like Congressman Young, it's still possible for him to support the bill, but he gives every indication he'll vote no.
If you vote for a clean 3-month debt extension and you say you vote on principle, then what set of principles keeps you from voting for a 6-month debt extension clean, or 1-year debt extension clean, or 3 months from now when they ask for another debt extension? How can you say, I will never, ever do that when you just did it 3 months ago?
Senator Lisa Murkowski has said that Congress should not tie the debt ceiling to spending cuts, and that's unlikely to happen in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Senate leaders indicated today the upper chamber will pick up whatever the House passes.
If the House proposal kind of takes us beyond the discussion so we can have a little bit of breathing room, that's worth looking at.
The president issued a statement late this afternoon saying he would not veto a 3-month extension, but it does little to quell the concerns of lenders, business owners, and investors. That's something Senator Murkowski agrees with. 3 months just doesn't provide the certainty the economy needs.
No. Probably more than there is right now, though.
The House could vote on the measure as early as Wednesday. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Today marks the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that created protections for abortion. In Juneau, a rally was held in front of the Capitol to protest the ruling, but inside the building, it's not yet clear how much time the legislature will spend considering anti-abortion bills. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
It's lunchtime, and about 100 people are standing in front of the Capitol steps. For a rally, it's pretty sedate. A few kids have lit candles, and a couple of people brought handmade signs. They're gathered because they don't believe abortion should be legal. Phyllis Kirkham, a member of Alaskans for Life, says it saddens her that there's a Planned Parenthood in the city that offers abortion services.
We just need to get rid of it here. It's just sad that it's come to our town, you know.
When she's asked what can be done about it, Kirkham says that she wants Roe v. Wade overturned. But she doesn't have any specific demands for the dozen or so state legislators that were present for the rally. With Republicans now in control of the House and the Senate, the subject was expected to be a big issue this year. But of the 100-plus bills that have been filed since the legislative session opened last week, not one of them deals with abortion. Senate Majority Leader John Coghill, who spoke at the rally, said that may change soon.
You know, coming into the session, it was told us, I hope you focus on energy and I hope you focus on these big economic issues, and I hope you don't take time for the social issues. And that's the problem with America.
Coghill told the crowd that a bill defining what counts as medically necessary abortion would eventually be introduced this session. Right now, the state must fund medically necessary abortions under Medicaid, according to a ruling by the Alaska Supreme Court. A bill that would narrow the definition was considered last year, but it didn't go anywhere. Beyond policy changes like that, though, Coghill says there's not much that the legislature can do to limit access to abortion.
The Supreme Court still is the supreme law of the land, but life is given of God. The Supreme Court doesn't understand it yet, but they will answer to God.
Representative Garen Tarr, a Democrat of Anchorage, says she wouldn't be surprised if legislation trying to restrict abortion were introduced. She's a former director for the Alliance for Reproductive Justice, and she serves on the House Health and Human Services Committee, where abortion bills get a hearing. Tara says that for her part, she is looking more at reproductive policy that would make abortion rare. but she adds that she would argue against any legislation that would place greater limits on abortion access.
What we don't want to forget is that when Alaskans are polled, the majority of the public do support a woman's right to choose, and that's an Alaskan value.
The Alaska Constitution contains a privacy clause that the state Supreme Court has interpreted as preventing explicit limitations on abortion. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a network of sensors will help monitor ocean acidification in Alaska.
We do know that there's a major catastrophic event on the way if we don't implement changes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Planning for the proposed Susitna-Watonna Hydro Dam is back on track. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had delayed the project after finding some of the studies inadequate, but the agency reversed that decision after receiving appeals from Governor Sean Parnell, Alaska's congressional delegation, and state lawmakers. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has more.
FERC originally found 13 of the 58 studies for the proposed 700-foot-tall dam to be inadequate and told the Alaska Energy Authority to clarify them, and they provided a time extension to do so. AEA objected, saying that the delay would make them miss the 2013 field study season. Now, the field studies can proceed at AEA's planned pace. AEA spokesperson Emily Ford says the AEA was stunned by FERC's request, saying the study plan development had been a collaborative process with the participation of FERC and other federal and state agencies, such as U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and Alaska State DNR.
With 58 studies covering, I think it's approximately 3,500 pages, the Susitna-Watonna Hydro revised study plan is likely the most detailed and comprehensive study plan ever submitted in a hydroelectric licensing effort. So our position is we're committed to getting the information that's needed. However, we needed to honor the integrated licensing process and a timeline that allowed us to get into the field this spring and early summer in order to be able to begin a lot of these multi-year study efforts.
By reversing their decision to postpone the study determination, FERC has granted AEA the ability to proceed with its 2013 field studies. Jan Koningsberg is director of the Alaska Hydropower Reform Coalition, a watchdog organization that is monitoring the Susitna Dam licensing process. Koningsberg says the pressure brought to bear by the legislature and governor has politicized the licensing process.
The governor's letter went to the chairman of the FERC commission and was copied to the delegation and essentially made a demand that was delay is unacceptable. Well, once you make that demand, you're essentially saying that the process you agreed to is not really the one you're going to follow.
The comment deadline for the revised study plan was Friday, January 18th, and FERC says it will deliver their study plan determination to the AEA by April 1st. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
The proposed Donlin gold mine on the Middle Kuskokwim River has started the long multi-step permitting process. But before any permits can be granted, the project is subject to an environmental impact statement. This includes a series of public meetings. Some have already taken place in rural Alaska, and another is scheduled for this evening in Anchorage. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart reports.
The proposed Donlin Gold Mine is a 16-year-old venture between Barrick Gold and Nova Gold to explore the estimated 33-million-ounce gold reserve. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is preparing the Environmental Impact Statement to analyze the effects of the open-pit gold mine, located 10 miles north of Crooked Creek, on the Kuskokwim River. The Corps isn't the only agency involved in the process. The Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency, along with other federal and local entities, all have a say. Officials say the study will identify potential physical, biological, and social impacts from all phases of the project and help to decide if the mine will be awarded the various permits needed to actually break ground. The nearly three-year EIS process is part of the National Environmental Policy Act and started December 14th. Don Cool, project manager with the Corps, says the first step is called the scoping process.
That's the period during which we're trying to gather information regarding any concerns or issues that may be out there.
Public comments were taken at meetings in Bethel, Aniak, and Crooked Creek. The next meeting is in Anchorage tonight at 6 p.m. at the Wilda Martson Theater. More meetings are scheduled for Quinnahock, New Napichuk, and Akiak. Public comments and concerns will be taken until March 29th.
And that information will be used in preparing the draft EIS.
Kuhl says that is the next step and should be completed in October 2014. Then Kuhl says there will be another series of public meetings to review the draft EIS. The final EIS is scheduled to come out in October 2015, with an ultimate decision on the permitting process coming November that same year. Communities along the Kuskokwim have raised concerns about the possible effects the almost 2,000-foot deep mine could have on subsistence foods. People are worried not only about the pollution the mining process could entail, but also the increased barge traffic along the Kuskokwim River. Donlin Gold has said it's committed to keeping the surrounding area free from tailings and other waste. The project summary includes plans for a waste storage facility and other safeguards. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers encourages anyone who wishes to comment on the study to attend one of the meetings or go to donlingoldeis.com or email comments to comments@donlingoldeis.com. Again, comments will be taken until March 29th. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Alaska will soon have a monitoring system for rising levels of acidity in the ocean. The state legislature provided $2.7 million for dollars to set up a network of buoy sensors along the coast. Scientists got an update on ocean acidification yesterday at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The ocean absorbs a large share of the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere through a chemical reaction that makes the water less alkaline. The pace of this reaction and where those waters show up got a lot more important once they started destroying entire crops at oyster farms along the coast of Washington. The oyster farmers quickly learned how to watch for that acidity and keep their oysters out of it once it washed in. Soon, the Alaska Ocean Observing System website will be showing acidity readings for the waters of Alaska. Jeremy Mathis runs an acidification research program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle and is a professor of oceanography at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says the buoy network will be a sort of early warning system for times when acidic waters rise to the surface or drift near shore.
We're going to begin next month deploying these sensors on these buoys that you see that are going to be able to measure CO2, pH, temperature, oxygen, and a number of other variables in real time, and they're going to be able to transmit that back to us in the lab. We're going to host it on the AUS website so that anybody that wants to look at it can go up and see what's going on with these conditions in the ocean, and hopefully we'll be able to use it much like they did in Oregon and Washington when they were faced with an event that was causing problems in the fishery. They did have some resource to fall back on that allowed them to manage their way through that.
Mathis said acid waters are welling up from the deep ocean but also melting from glaciers. When they wash in, they make it harder for marine organisms to form shells. Laboratory experiments have been showing the damage for years, but now Nina Bednarsik, a researcher at Mathis Lab, has documented it in the field as well, observing a plankton species called pteropod being damaged by corrosive waters.
She found actual dissolution of pteropods down in the Southern Ocean. So off of Antarctica, she found carbon dioxide concentrations that were driving aragonite undersaturation, and she found natural pteropod populations in this region that were actually dissolving and breaking down under the conditions that they saw. And those conditions that they observed in the Southern Ocean are very similar to the conditions that we see here in the Gulf of Alaska and in the Bering Sea.
And the search will soon be underway for the same thing in Alaska waters.
We're kicking off a project this year. We're working with Russ Hopcroft and his group at UAF to see if we can find evidence or at least see what's going on with the natural pteropod populations in the Gulf of Alaska and see ultimately how they're responding.
The pteropod's a critical species because it's a major food source for pink salmon. Any depletion of pteropod yields an even greater depletion of salmon. Mathis said the ocean will remain productive, but rising acidity will change the species mix.
I asked in the beginning, is the sky really falling? And I think the simple answer right now is not yet. Not yet, but we do know that there is a major catastrophic event on the way if we don't implement changes.
Mathis says the acidity of the ocean fluctuates tremendously and animals have adapted to these fluctuations, but now there's a steep upward trend that's been obvious for the past decade, a far faster rate of change than was seen the last time the oceans got acidic, about 55 million years ago. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
A new dockside safety exam requirement for many commercial fishing boats has been postponed for a couple of years. The once voluntary safety checks were slated to become mandatory last October for vessels that operate more than 3 miles from land. However, Congress pushed that deadline back with passage of the Coast Guard's latest funding bill. Ken Lawrenson is the Coast Guard's Fishing Vessel Safety Coordinator in Alaska.
Part of the effect of that was to delay the implementation of those mandatory exams into October of 2015.
Lawrenson estimates more than half of Alaska vessels that fish more than 3 miles offshore have already participated in the voluntary exams and received the safety decal over the years.
Mainly because they recognize that it's a good idea because of the unforgiving, harsh nature of the marine environment up here, as well as a lot of those vessels already have to comply with observer requirements. And so their insurance underwriters, there's another reason for them to go ahead and have that decal. They have already been doing that for the last 10 years, 15 years in some cases.
According to Lawrenson, participation in the voluntary program has been less frequent among vessels that operate within 3 miles of shore in Alaska. He estimates only about 15% to 20% of boats in that category have received the decal. He encourages fishermen to get the decal whether or not it's required.
It's always a good thing, I think, to put an extra set of eyeballs looking at the safety and training of the crew. That's certainly an important component of survival out here. It's a dangerous business. We all kind of accept that. But that doesn't mean that there's not an obligation, I think, to do what should be done. And certainly having the Coast Guard on board and establish that relationship is, I think, part of the expectation for most reasonable folks.
Regardless of the delay in the new requirements, Lawrenson notes that the exams remain mandatory for some vessels, including Bering Sea crabbers and any boats that have to carry federal fishery observers. Two dozen kids in Homer were given a chance to test their teamworking skills, imagination, and patience on a recent Saturday as they designed and built their own exploration rovers. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve looked on as teams assembled robots at the Homer Public Library.
Everyone knows robots are awesome.
I don't know what all this trouble is about, but I'm sure it must be your fault.
And as 24 kids learned during Robot Garage, they come in many different forms. There are robots that perform tasks humans don't want to, like vacuuming, and even those that are programmed to play games like ping pong. The Seattle Museum of Flight's Marina Hernandez explained how the machine, which looks a bit like RoboCop, actually works.
This robot, which is called Topio, has two cameras, and these cameras help it to know where the ping pong ball is, where it's traveling, and then help it to position its arm in the right spot. So that it can hit the ping pong ball. And something else special about him is that he has something called artificial intelligence. Not all robots have artificial intelligence, but for Topio, it means that He gets better each time he plays ping pong.
She provided a seminar for the kids by satellite and discussed the history of the machines, where the word robot originally came from, science fiction, of course, and handed out their mission. The children would get into teams of two or three and build a rover, similar to the machines scientists have landed on Mars. The teams had no instruction manuals. All they had to work with was a kit with plastic pieces, five motors, wires, and a control panel. The rover had to move back and forth and be able to pick up objects. The three-man team of Xander, Charlie, and Austin first tested the speed of their motors and began devising a plan.
The red side goes in. The red side. The red side.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah, the red side goes in. And we need to put it the exact same way. That doesn't... So, Xander, you can be controlling it?
Yeah.
With one of them, with one of the wheels, you're going to have to be pressing forward to go forward, and with one of the wheels, you're going to have to be pressing backward.
As Denver and Eric worked, they came across a major flaw. Their wires popped out of the motors consistently. Nevertheless, the two of them made it work.
Tires roll, check. Okay. Try the work, check. Okay, claw. Close.
Woohoo! We have a working robot!
After all the teams completed their robots, they gathered around a square to test them out by clamping onto small objects and carrying them out of the square. For the most part, the bots performed the task without a hitch, though there was one troublemaker.
Is Bob the killer robot of the bunch, you guys?
Yeah, he can smash. Bob smash! If there's a really slow robot in front of him, he can smash it.
At the end of the day, all the kids said they loved that they could spend the afternoon building a robot, but they would prefer wireless robots for next time. In Homer, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Mark Earhart in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Ariel Van Cleve in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. You have the power to help others when you file online for your PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. You can make a real difference and support causes that matter most to you, from feeding the hungry, supporting youth in education, or sustaining the arts. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Wells Fargo Bank, and the Matsu Health Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.